The Senate Revenue Committee, another week. What is today? April 4th. So the order we're going to go today is we're going to do Senate Bill 847, then we'll do 996, followed by 412, and hear from Vice Chair Starr and Senator Brzezinski on their work group, and then SJ 14 is on its way to the floor. We put that up as a, if we needed to. So let's open a hearing or a work session on Senate Bill 847. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. Senate Bill 847 provides a 10-year exemption from property tax for a newly constructed single-unit owner-occupied that's located within a city's distressed area. A single unit is a single dwelling unit that is occupied by a single person or family, and it may be a single detached housing unit or a row house or a townhouse that shares a common wall with other similar units or potentially a condominium. A distressed area designated in an area that has a significant number of vacant or abandoned structures in it but cannot exceed the total land mass of the city. A unit that's qualified for the exemption must have a market value of no more than the lesser of 120% of the city's median housing value or a percentage adopted by the city. A distressed geographic area is defined by statute as a deteriorated residential area that is unsafe and may contain a significant number of vacant or abandoned dwelling units. I say this because quite a few of the projects that I've been alerted to go on in infill areas within the city of Portland, and the tax expenditure report that I reviewed also indicated that most of the applications are coming out of the Portland area, metro area. At the public hearing, we discussed testimony from the City of Portland representatives that indicated that applications from last year are pending approval, and that could be, and these could be not be approved if the program is reinstated. Testimony also by PDC staff indicated that in FY0304, roughly 2,000 new single-family houses had been built in designated distressed areas, and the price cap for home in 2003 was $170,000, and this was moderate for home prices in the Portland area. Prior to the sunset, this particular Senate bill will reinstate a provision or a previous statute that sunsetted in June of 2003. However, when it was in existence, it existed for qualified properties, but it did not include condominiums or other types of housing units that did not give the owners title to the land. And let's say, in the expenditure report 0305, the estimated value of this exemption was $2.8 million. And $3.2 million for FY0103 and FY0305, respectively. The estimates do not include estimates for the exemptions of condominiums, of course. And prior to the sunset date, the estimated FY0103 biennium revenue loss for this exemption was $2.8 million on an estimated exempt property value of $90.8 million. Under the old law, too, I should add, under the previous law, the exemption would not exist on the land value, just the housing value. I mean, just the housing value. And under the current law, proposed law, that also would exist, except that for condominiums, there is no land value. So you're not getting any feedback from that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the estimated revenue impact is slightly lower than the one that you had last year when this bill was also considered, but I took it down because I felt that most of the infill projects didn't suggest that there would be a 25% ratio of new condominiums relative to, or new, you know, townhouses and relative to existing the old law. So the current 0507 estimate is $3.9 million and 0709 is $4.2
million. Thank you. Questions for Mary? So did we ever, and Marge, you may, I don't know if you want to come up, the only question, what a gentlemanship, gets up and, that's not on the record, so you're, at least you're safe there. So the question that was put forth that I don't know that we completely answered last time was, for those folks that are in the, I guess, the period that the law was not in effect, did we get a sense of how many and how we would allow them to participate in the program with strict rules to ensure that it's only those folks that had applied to PDC or were caught when the law lagged?
Mr. Chairman, Marge Kapori, representing the City of Portland. That is my understanding. I think you had some testimony last week about how, well, I'm not sure whether you had testimony last week about how many people had gotten stranded and were sort of in the queue, but it's my understanding that they would be treated exactly the way any new applicant would be treated under the legislation that's before you, that if you're worried about someone slipping in and getting the tax break, that doesn't really happen the way the bill is drafted. The tax abatement starts on July 1st of 2005, so it's not retroactive. This would just catch people who had anticipated that they would be eligible for this tax abatement and had made their purchase decisions based on the assumption that they would have that tax abatement. So this allows them to get it, but it's a going forward process.
So how many, can we pin that number down of how many are caught, were caught between the period that the law was not into effect or the property tax exemption?
Mr. Chairman, I can't give you an exact number. I doubt that it's more than maybe 10, 20 at PDC. I don't think it's a lot.
Okay. So between...
I know that there's one in the City of Milwaukee as well, which is why Representative Tomei is very interested in this program. Okay. So I know that that person exists, but I don't. We're not talking about hundreds.
Okay. Okay. I thought from the previous hearing that that actually might have been much more than 10 or 20.
It's not my understanding that that's the case, but we did want to have these people be eligible because they did make the decisions based on going forward program.
Questions for Mary or Marge? No amendments on this bill, Mary?
There's no objection.
Would accept a motion.
Are we in work session?
We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move to send a bill 847 to the floor. Is it to the floor?
Yeah.
To do pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger has moved Senate Bill 847 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections to that motion? So ordered. John, I think Senator Carter would like to carry this bill. So, three sessions. Well, we won't go a fourth, at least in the state senate. So, close the work session. Senator Carter will carry.
Thank you, Senator.
You're welcome. 996. Is that Lizbeth? Open a work session on Senate Bill 996, a bill we've had two hearings on, and a dash one amendment is in play.
Yeah. Senator Chairman Deckard and committee members, with Senate Bill 996, you have a dash one amendment, and the dash one amendment is just filling in that blank in the bill. So, again, this is a bill on the Affordable Housing Tax Credit. That basically is looking at increasing that annual cap on the amount that can be certified by the Housing and Community Services Department. So we've had several hearings on this, and basically this change will apply to tax years 2005 and beyond, and the amendment is setting that cap at $11 million. And basically, if you look at the Dash 1 amendment, the issue is it doesn't have a real big revenue impact to begin with, and that's because housing has to, it has a kind of like a supply of reserve loans that are already there. And so, that's under the existing $6 million cap. So this is going to, when you're increasing this to $11 million, it can't take place right away. So that's why you're seeing a gradual increase in this revenue impact. So for the 05-07 biennium, it would have a revenue revenue, additional revenue loss of like $959,509. And then as you go out, it starts growing because basically we're going to, the department will know that they have a higher cap, and so they'll be allowing more loans to come into reserve, and then it takes about a year from being in reserve to them becoming part of the certified loans, and then those are what actually get the tax credit once those loans become certified. So that's why it's slowly increasing there. By 0709, it's $6.9 million, and by 2009-11 biennium, $8.7 million.
Thank you. Questions for Liz Beth. So who can, I'd like to bring someone up to talk about the 9 to 11. I'm just searching, and Mark, you might end up being that person. Do you want to bring someone? Bob, do you want to come up? So the choice committee we had was 9 to 11 million, and I think the 11 makes it self-sustaining, but if we've got now 3. So whoever wants to take that, explain the Dash 1 amendments and talk about why 11 million might be preferable in the sense that at that point you have a self-sustaining program for affordable housing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Housing Alliance. The Mr. Rapine may be able to elaborate more in terms of the number, but we don't think it will be self-sustaining forever. But we do believe that 11 million will put us out, we believe, as much as 10 years. So we're not having to come back and revisit the cap. And as staff has indicated, it is the cost grows each year as we fill that pipeline. But we are now at our limit at the 6 million, and that's why we wanted the increase.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Bob Rapine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. We were directed by you, Mr. Chairman, or staff, to do a run scenario on the $9 million versus the $11 million. Again, it's the, as Mr. Nelson suggests, it's a capacity issue. Where do you want to reach the cap again? At what point in time? So I think at the meeting in Portland, I actually testified to you in the committee that if you had a number of $14 million, you probably would have a sustainable number because of the process of those loans that are maturing at the end will be able to be rolled over again. So there's some continuum that would be taking place at 14. However, at 11, it does move the necessity of the cap being renewed for years out, considerable years out. And so that's probably the answer to your question.
Thank you. So I guess the natural question, and we just have a less of a revenue impact, is, are there enough projects that you know of, Bob, or that you could actually do in 05-07 to get to 11 million? And so you'd have to increase the number of projects that are occurring that would apply for the lender's credit. And that's where at least 9 was the agreed upon number early on.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think one of the things also you have to factor in with the 9 is 9 factor was probably developed also on capacity, the need, plus we have been choking down on the amount of credits that have been made available per unit. So to maximize, so it would suggest to you then, instead of getting all the credits you could get to maximize the reduction in the rents, we would be, instead of reducing the rents down all the way down, we might be only reducing them down to 50% median as opposed to 30% median income. So we were trying to spread the use of tax credits by not giving the full allocation to all the projects. And in some cases, we were telling projects to, if they were coming up for, let's say, 20 tax credit units, we would say, you'll get 10, but you're going to have to just have normal rates on the other 10. So I think that's where the deviation comes between the 9 and the 11. Mm-hmm. We have enough applications. In the current CFC round, we have about a 60%, a 200% oversubscribe of the credits. Generally, most of those are all looking for Oregon lenders tax credits. So we are running short, and so we're kind of allocating those out now as opposed to what we had been doing in the past.
Great. Questions for Bob or Mark? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Senator Metzger.
I had a question regarding the fiscal on this. Are the numbers we have, both for the $11 million cap and the $9 million cap, mm-hmm. are these over and above the numbers of the current program that's capped? Okay.
That's right.
These are over and above.
That's right.
Other questions, comments? So we have the Dash 1 amendments. Senate Bill 996. Senator Stark.
Yes, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 996.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 996. Any discussion? Any objections? No order. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 996 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 996 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections to that motion? So ordered. I will carry it unless someone would like to carry it, and then I'd be happy to just back you up. I'll carry that bill. Okay, close the work session on Senate Bill 996 and open a work session on urban renewal, Senate Bill 412. And we had a work group on this bill consisting of Senator Pozanski, Senator Starr, and a number of other interested parties. And so I think I'll let Senator Pozanski and Senator Starr lead us off on urban renewal, and then we'll who staffed the work group and let us know how it went down in LRO for the last few weeks. And thank you for the many meetings and the hard work that, Mary, you provided Senator Pozanski and Senator Starr.
Thank you.
Senator Decker, I guess what I would tell you is that Senator Starr and I return with all of our digits intact, no limps, no nothing, and so I think we made it through the process. It was a very good work group, very cordial, and what we did is we came up with really two consensus items that we, as a work group, could move forward together on, and based on the directions of the chair, that's what we're bringing forward. And as anyone who's in my position would know, when you get to the technical stuff, it's time to turn it over to staff, and so maybe we'll let Mary go through the changes that we've made. I mean, bottom line is that there's two things that we're going to be looking at. One of them is in the area that notice is going to have to be required to be given to the special service districts areas that could be impacted by an urban renewal, and set some criteria as to when that notice is required. And also, we talked about the undercertification proposal that was out, and basically that also was discussed to the point of where the urban renewal authority would in fact be allowed to certify less than the maximum amount that's calculated by the division of the tax, and this is one that we felt that should go forward. I should point out that one of the areas that we did look at and we had discussions here in our committee was the opt-out provisions for special districts, including schools and fire protection. There was not consensus in this area, and it was one that we felt that raise more questions as to how you actually implement such a proposal to be really reasonable and fair to all those that are participants within the urban renewal. If you let someone opt out, would you freeze their rates at that point? Would they when or if and when would you allow them to come back in and get the benefits after the length of the urban renewal district had run its course? And it's one of those things that we just felt that in our limited time we would not be able to accomplish that, and maybe that was something that should be looked at in a broader sense during more of an interim type of study.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And so if it's all right, we'll pass the hard work over to the person that actually kept us on task. And Mary was very instrumental in capturing what we were talking about and making sure the group got there.
Thank you. Senator Starr, did you want to add?
Well, I concur with what Senator Pozanski has said. I think the fact that we leave it open so that districts may certify less than the full amount gives opportunity to those other taxing districts to make their case, and so I think that is a step in the right direction as far as impact to schools or fire districts or whatever. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Mary, you want to walk us through the dash one amendments?
Certainly.
And then we'll bring a few folks up that were involved in the work group.
Okay. As Senator Prezansky mentioned, Senate Bill 412-1 proposes that whenever an urban renewal plan is created or substantially changed, and by that I mean the boundaries change or by more than 1%, or the maximum indebtedness changes by a substantial amount, which is more than 1%, then the local governing authority must issue a public notice and invite local taxing districts to a public hearing in order to hear their views. They're acting in an advisory capacity in that sense, but they are they do have notice. And so, as I'll discuss in a minute, based on the testimony that we had during the two-day orientation, several people requested more government oversight, more transparency in the system, more involvement. And as you read through the statute, current law, it seems like there are a lot of ways in which the governing authorities can and do consult and confer with the taxing districts. However, from our work group, we understand that that process is not uniform across all the urban renewal boards. And so the intent of the work group, I think, was to try to find ways to improve the process. And that was one of the reasons we have the recommendations set forth here. The option, the second option addresses that. Obviously, if jurisdictions feel at some point that they're not getting benefit from a particular plan, and during the work group we discussed several situations in which a project may have been funded and a building may have been funded through urban renewal, and at some point the building was completely built and maybe it deteriorated relative to the funding period. And so we discussed the fact that maybe there should be ways in which fire districts or other districts could opt out of a program if they felt there wasn't maximum benefit being derived from it. However, we discussed that, and it seemed, or the group discussed it, and it appears that in actuality, most of the urban renewal plans that are adopted usually include infrastructure, and so the duration of the funding period usually is shorter than the lifespan of the project, and so you are getting benefit. There may be few cases where that doesn't occur, but in general, it does. The idea, as Senator Prezansky said, to include the opt-out provisions, well, that again may seem, you know, to make sense at one level, but then on another, if you were a bonding source, you might not consider the sources of your repayment evaporating without some kind of schedule may not be in the best interest of getting a bond issued at the lowest possible rate. Okay, so the second provision that the group came up with, which was a sort of a compromise, as opposed to having an opt-out provision during the middle, let's say, of a financing period, the group suggested that perhaps at the beginning of the period, during the planning stages, if the governing authority wanted to decide on an amount that's less than the maximum amount, that was the time and the place to possibly do it. Okay. So those were the two. Based on those issues, the group decided to come forth with the two recommendations that Senator Prezansky mentioned and I mentioned here. And that will add, there's three options under current law that governing authorities have in order to decide how they want to establish their funding. And this will give them a fourth.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that is it, sir.
Thank you.
Chair.
Somewhat of a mend it, don't end it approach, it seems, to keeping the system intact and just making a few changes. So what happened to the questions for Mary or for Senator Prezansky and Senator Starr? So the Karen Williams proposal, for lack of a better word, that would allow a district, if they're 10 or 15 years into it, to levy less Was that discussed and did that...
Yes, Mr. Chair, it was discussed, and it was discussed, and then the consensus preferred the certification, the proposal that we made. So the Karen, I want to call it the Karen Williams proposal, but it isn't. It is one that she voiced in order to give us an example of what that type of proposal would be. And in that, you could decide it periodically if you wanted to change the amount of the levy. And this doesn't do this. This moves everything forward where you would really basically have to decide up front how much you want to commit to. But it could be less than the maximum.
And the other issue of extending the life of a district past its... Did y'all discuss if you wanted to extend the life of a district past its 20 or 30-year initial conception, making it more stringent, was that discussed in detail? Or
I do not recall discussing that, but maybe there are people here that know urban renewal legislation better than I, so I don't even want to attempt to try to second guess that one. My thought is that it would fall into the category of substantial changes, and therefore if you were going to do that, you'd have to go through the whole process again, which would again invite taxing districts to that hearing, and maybe that's not done consistently now. And so although I heard a lot of issues at the orientation, I'm hoping, or the work group is hoping, that this process will alleviate those issues in the future if it can't remediate them.
And I think both Senator Starr and I would concur with that. I think that's the approach and why we thought the notice part was so important in setting the framework of if there's a substantial change and clearly setting something out on a longer period of time than what it's originally calls for would meet that definition and would in fact require at least the notice and the hearing and those taxing districts that could be impacted, continuing to be impacted, to be at the table or allowed to be at the table to discuss their issues and concerns before action was actually taken about, in this particular case, extension of the urban renewal district in time.
So those examples that we heard, this would bring everyone back to the table if they were going into year 42 or 50, 43. This folks would have been back at the table again in year 30, discussing the second, I guess, iteration of the urban renewal district under substantial changes.
That's great.
Great. Let's bring up who on the work group would like to kind of represent the different points of view. I mean, Chip, do you want to represent the PDC point or any of those three huddled right there? And
that looks like one group right there.
Someone from the fire districts, and if I'm missing anyone, I'm trying to think who else was involved.
This is pretty much it. I think Squires was there, for the fire districts and kind of speaking on behalf of the school at some level, but as a special attacking district, but I think
similar concerns were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm general counsel at the Portland Development Commission. I think Dr. Ayala's description of the amendments is really correct. The issues that you, Mr. Chair, were talking about, the amendments, in my view, really capture the local flavor of these decisions, and it provides a beefed up notice requirement to the local jurisdictions and requires them to be brought in to give testimony or give their recommendations around those issues. And then under the language of the amendment as well, the underlevy, which is the Karen Williams proposal, the ability of them to make a decision that they're only going to draw as much tax dollars as they need perhaps to meet their debt service or to cover a current project, that could occur each year. So it isn't something that occurs, only in five-year increments or something along those lines. So it maximizes local decision-making and their flexibility, but it also encourages collaboration among the local districts around these decisions, more so than current law mandates.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lazenby. Questions for Chip? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alec Jensen with Puyallup Valley Fire and Rescue, and I concur that the recommendations do in large part reflect what, as a bystander observer of the committee process, came up with. However, as it relates to the opt-out issue, My recollection will differ ever so slightly because I don't think we had substantive discussion of that issue. In fact, when we reached that issue, the consensus was that we would not have consensus, and that representing Ms. Squires, I mean, she's boldly stated, and it's clear we're not going to reach consensus on this, so let's not essentially waste our time leaving us to our own designs to advance our respective agenda. Our issue was not opt out in the interim, but opt out in the beginning. And our issue was, frankly, not opt out as much as it was give cities and counties the option to opt us out at the beginning, not an automatic opt out. Put that tool that they currently do not have in their toolbox. Because today, I believe that certainly in the area that we serve, there are cities that would choose to essentially excuse the fire district from the impacts of urban renewal. It would be their choice, but they currently do not have that tool in their toolbox. So that essentially is a revisitation of our issue.
Uh-huh. And yeah, can we stay on this one? Do you have a point on?
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
So. I'm trying to think of the argument against that because it's permissive in nature to allow cities, and perhaps that's something that were there arguments against it that you recall? Or
the one argument that I have heard against it, and I don't want to be flippant, but it's the slippery slope. It's that if you give cities and counties the ability to opt you out today, next session you'll be back asking for automatic opt out, and. I can only say that the arguments for automatic opt-out today are the same that we'd advance for giving cities and counties the option. We do not believe that automatic opt-out is appropriate. We do think that jeopardizes the whole essence of urban renewal. What we want is we want to put that tool in the toolbox. If there are other arguments, and again, I think you accurately portray it as permissive. There are other arguments. I haven't heard them.
If, just on that point, I mean, I think the whole structure of urban renewal as an investment model, I think, weighs against the sort of permissive opt-out. And this is a compromise because it allows the district to take less money and to try to increase the amount of revenue that the other districts are taking without getting into the bond covenants and the reliability of the revenue stream and things of that nature. I got a welter of notes here, Mr. Chair, as to your point, it is that what the amendments didn't cover that we discussed in the work group is that extensions are an extension of time, i.e. if we've got an urban renewal district like we have in Portland and the downtown waterfront, and we're running up against the time at which we could borrow more funds and we want to extend that time, which is something that the special districts have raised as an issue of, well, gee, they're going to do this for 15 years and then 10 years into it, they decide to extend it another 20 years and borrow more money, or in the last year they do. Extensions are not included in this definition of substantial amendments.
Substantial changes.
And right, so we would be fine with that addition if you wanted to add that to the definition of substantial amendment, that extensions of time in which districts may incur further debt is part of the substantial amendment process. That'd be fine. With us. It's not included in this current draft, but it's a concept I think that would capture part of the concerns of the special districts as well.
Mm. Well, I'd like to, in my mind, and I'll defer to the two senators who worked on this, but in my mind, I would say both of those changes, the permissive nature for cities, and we can call someone else up to talk about that issue, but also, if you're going to extend the life of a district, I would like that to be included in the substantial changes definition, but
Mr. Chair, if I may, the substantial change component, I think we talked in the work group that we anticipated that would, in fact, be part of it. I mean, if someone's going to extend it out, since in time we felt that was, and so if it's not captured there in the words that we have, then I would think that it should be. But I think that we all were in agreement with that. Regarding the permissiveness of opting out a special district, I guess what I would say is that it was never discussed, never brought up on the table for us to consider as an alternative or an option. Because, I mean, based on what I'm hearing right now, if it had been brought up as where the special districts may have been during the work group, then we wouldn't have that discussion. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that I guess it would seem, I'm surprised, maybe this is my ignorance in urban renewal law, that the urban renewal district or those that are farming it don't have that authority already. And it, to me, it's something that they should have that option and put it in the toolbox. But what I'm going to tell you right now, that was not brought up during the work group, because it's one of those things that making, as the chair said, permissive is something that I think would have been, it may have been reluctantly agreed to by some or opposed, but I think that if I could speak so bold, I think Senator Starr and I would have been okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Question? Senator Starr and Senator Metzger.
I don't understand how it's excluded if you're proposing to raise more money and extend the time. It looks like that to me that falls under the definition of substantially amended, unless the ORS 457.085 says something else, and I don't have that information.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, my assumption, I remember us discussing the extension in the work group. My assumption, along with Senator Przanski, was that wasn't in there. Mr. Tashman pointed out that it wasn't explicitly in there, and I agreed with him that I would point out to the committee that, just for clarity's sake, we might want to put that into the definition of substantial amendment to capture the notice provisions for the local jurisdiction. So it really is more a matter of clarity than it is argument on a fine point of law, Senator Starr. So that's on the extension basis.
Senator Metzger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Chip, I would be interested in your response to this issue about the opt-out. Since we have a city government or a county government that would initiate an urban rural district, that they would weigh all these issues in deciding that it's in their best interest, their community's best interest, the city or the county, to create this district to incent whatever type of behavior in housing and development that they would wish. And so if, in fact, they were to go through developing a district and have no option as to decide what components of that would be, or they were to decide that at one component, whether that's a school district or a fire district, for whatever had a compelling argument that they wished they could draw a custom plan about, but had no option to do that, and it would have to be the city council or others who would have ultimately make a decision of what they would or would not use based on what they think the best objectives are. Give me what you think would be a compelling argument as to why they should not be trusted to have that tool.
I don't think it's a matter of trust, Senator Metzger. I think it's a matter of the sequence in which these districts come into existence and the way the bond market looks at them. We've discussed previously that there's a difference here between normal governmental operations where a pot of money is raised and then it's spent. And what we're doing here is showing the bond markets a sliver of revenue and saying that revenue is going to be steady and grow over the next period of years, and we borrow against that. What's in the amendments is a proposal that would say at a certain point in time in the future, you can look at what your needs are to cover your debt service and any ongoing projects that you have, and just levy that amount for urban renewal and any excess value that you've grown because of your efforts can then be dispersed to the special districts. That's a much more orderly process than what permissive withdrawal would do and what the way the bond markets would react to it.
Well, I'm not talking about permissive withdrawal. I'm talking about informing the urban renewal project in the first place, that you make a determination of what the revenue streams would be, and you might exclude someone. Wouldn't it be, you talk about the bond market, that would be part of the consideration when you anticipate starting an urban renewal, project, that, here are the different tools available, you'll get feedback from the bond market as to whether this is viable or not, and then you make a decision. So I'm not talking about down the stream, I'm talking about what our other testimony was, is in creating this district in the first place, that these would be the revenue sources that you would apply or not apply, and get feedback as to whether that's viable to go to market with. I don't understand why.
With or without various jurisdictions opting in or out at the front end of it.
At the head of the.
Well, I mean, I made a suggestion early on when we were beginning to discuss these concepts that since we were dealing with an investment model, we'd have to consider some sort of mechanism for those that opt out not sharing in the appreciation of the investment that the other jurisdictions were doing. That's something I think that's beyond the can of us to do at this stage in the legislative session. But again, I go back to the investment model. If Senator Deckard and Senator Prezansky and I go into an investment deal, we're the ones that should share in the upside. If you decide you don't want to go in with us, there's no reason that you, if you're 5 or you're 10 or you're 15, should lay claim to the increased value that our investments have yielded for all of us in the neighborhood. So I suppose that could be worked out, but because all the tax monies go into, you know, a single pot for distribution, I think it would be require us to take some time to figure out how, if you opt out, you don't also suffer a windfall for failure to invest on the front end. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the mechanism you'd have to look at if you were going to go forward with that concept, rather than just say, well, I want to opt out because I want to use my tax monies this year. How do you deal with that windfall on the upside for those jurisdictions that did participate?
Yes, sir.
Senator Deckard, may I respond? I think that I agree with what Chip's saying, that there needs to be some discussion in that realm, but I think the reality of the long-term impacts of urban renewal plans needs to be recognized. The one that we're contemplating in Washington County today, one that Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue supports, has a 45-year window. That the fire district is not made whole until the year 2050. That we don't have an employee. Our youngest employee will be retired, and I will be 95 years old, God willing, mm-hmm. when this urban renewal plan that we're currently contemplating expires. So, yes, 45 years from now, we probably ought to have some discussion about how we adjust the consideration. But the reality is we're talking about very, very long-term financial planning.
Mm-hmm. And again, just on what I've said previously as we've had the conversation around this topic is, without going into great detail about how ancient I am, I don't expect to be living in my house in 30 years, but I refinanced it last year for 30 years, and I get a benefit today through my tax benefits, through the mortgage that I pay and all these other things, plus my ownership potential, because I end up going through a financing mechanism like that. So the numbers that are associated with these financing mechanisms is, if you look at them in isolation, that's fairly compelling. But if you look at it as a general financing tool and the fact that special districts also benefit in the short term from the increased valuation from the investment that ends up getting done, that's a little bit of a red herring argument to a certain extent.
Well, yeah, please.
Well, I was just curious. Chip, couldn't you have something where, on the point that you brought up about capturing, quote, the windfall at the end of the project, couldn't you have something in which the jurisdiction could, at its own discretion, for whatever reason, you know, at the head of a project, you know, opt out a particular taxing district within that, the special district? And as part of that tool to be able to do that, coincidentally with that decision, would have to present or adopt a refinancing plan for that particular jurisdiction that would take effect upon the end of the completion of the urban renewal period, so that yes, they could opt somebody out, assuming they put together, you know, an agreement of what those dollars would be upon the end, to kind of address the issue that you brought up why should this district then share in the windfall, the greater value the rest of the districts will have evolved. So you adopt whatever that kind of formula would be as part of the decision to allow that district to be opted out.
I suppose theoretically, but this comes back to what I said earlier. I think, you know, we've gone down the road with this vehicle and in this work group around these concepts to get to a model like that and to look at it statewide. I mean, I my sense is that there are some unique circumstances involving urban renewal that are going on in Clackamas County around some of the districts there. I can only really speak to the cumbersomeness of trying to do that in my jurisdiction in Portland, and also looking at the different types of districts that we have where it is not a project, but it's multiple projects over a long period of time. I know that in some of our older urban renewal districts that have been around for a while where there's been a significant amount of investment that's gone on, there already is assessed valuation above what we need for debt service that's already going back into the pot for distribution to the jurisdictions. They don't feel it because it's just a part of what normally comes to them, but it's a direct result of urban renewal investment, and it's parsing that out, I think, would get to be very difficult if you on the front end allowed districts to opt out. I mean, I just think it's difficult to do in this vehicle at this time. I mean, I'd be happy to have further conversations with you about theoretically. I just don't think it's practical at this point. That's my view.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I'm not capturing here, and Chip, in your discussion, it sounds to me that you're putting the premise that it's going to be the special service district that's opting out. I understand that they would, under our amendment, would have the notice that something's coming up. They would go in and they'd make their case, but the reality, it would be the urban renewal district that would be actually making that decision. And if they were going to make that decision, it would seem like they'd be formulating, and I'm going to use the perspective of seeing how school funding now taking place or not taking place, and where some communities are opting to basically try to take a position to assist their schools. I'm not saying that they would, but they could at some point during an urban renewal district creation say, well, we could bring the school, or the school district would be in, but if we keep them out, then they're able to do this, this, and this during this period of time. Now, I understand your concern, and I think that's something that it's probably going to make it more highly unlikely to see urban renewal districts opting out anyone, because when you get to the bottom or to the end and there is some of that windfall or you're bringing everyone back up, who's going to get the benefit at what level? And, I mean, whether the special district's going to agree to the urban renewal district on the front end, we will permissibly take you out, but you also understand that when we reach the end of this 20 years, you're going to, not reap the benefits. Who knows what that might
correct.
Be. It just seems to me what I'm hearing now is on the permissive side, the control is still with urban renewal district. Now, it may be a little bit more challenging for the members of that district to say, well, we're going to keep you in, we're not going to knock you out. But at least that's just more food for thought and discussion.
Mm-hmm. A couple of observations. One, in most areas, for the Portland Development Commission is a little unusual in that we are a standalone urban renewal agency. In most jurisdictions around Oregon, what happens is the city council or the county commissioners take off that hat and put on their urban renewal hat. So it's those local elected officials that exercise that authority. That's the first piece. The second piece is, I think, the issues that you're talking about in terms of looking to support schools or other jurisdictions or what the immediate need is really addressed by the mechanism that the work group adopted in terms of the underlevy procedure. Because what that allows you to do is even midstream in the middle of an urban renewal effort to look and say, you know, we have some other local needs, but we can meet our obligations in terms of debt service and some of these other things and balance those locally in terms of not taking as much as an urban renewal district might be entitled to take under the statute. And so you can do that balancing from year to year. I mean, I appreciate Senator Metzger's point of, well, you know, why not go back and do that at the very beginning? I think that there's a lot of numbers to crunch and a lot of walking around that concept before there's something that would be comfortable. But what's in this amendment really gets at least that mechanism there for all the existing districts right now where you're able to take an annual look and balance it out.
So, Chip, do you see how this is just hard conceptually, I think, for us because it's permissive and because, just from my vantage point, it allows a jurisdiction, say, we'll pick Astoria in this one since they're not here. They could say, well, you know, we're going to go out and do this great plan, which is actually in effect and is having great results, but we're going to leave out our local fire district for reasons all associated with our Clatsop County situation here. So let's leave them out. And it's just at the beginning. So it's just hard. It's hard for me to rationalize why you wouldn't give them that ability if, in fact, they just don't have that ability today.
Well, again, I mean, I can only just, I understand where, I understand the conceptual difficulty. Again, I think that the investment model is what really drives this. And so if they're going to be out, then they shouldn't participate in the upside of it as well. The underlevy allows you to, allows those local governments and local government at its best to talk among themselves in a very public forum and make a determination that they're going to take only what they need to meet their debt service, thereby increasing the taxed harvest for the other jurisdictions on an annual basis. That's what it would allow them to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to be a compromise.
Yeah, and come on up, Senator Pazanski.
I guess a couple of things, Chip. What I'm hearing as to this permissive is going to allow basically another tool, not take away from what's been agreed to by the work group on the annual review as to under, you know, the underlevy. But I guess the part that, if I understand your belief of how this would work for this under certification part money, the underlevy, we would basically say that every year the urban renewal district is going to have an opportunity to take the snapshot, look at it where it's at, and if, say, a special district such as a school comes in and says, man, we really need to get some relief for this cycle, would you be willing to only collect what you need for debt service, allowing us to reap the benefit of this 1 year of bringing in money, and then maybe in another year you can go back to your full amount under the certification?
Correct.
And if that's the case, and I understand how that really does in fact work for those special or those urban renewal districts that are already in existence,
mm-hmm.
What I'm hearing now is that we're going to also give the opportunity for that urban renewal district at the time of creation to say, in the beginning, we are going to do this, and we're not going to wait for a year to reflect before we maybe make some tinkering to it, which is under this current plan. Because what I'm hearing is that we give the special district, I guess, the opportunity at the beginning and the creation of this additional amendment that is being proposed to say on the front end that they want to do this. And as compared to keeping everyone with the compromise fix and waiting for at least 1 year before that subject's visited.
If I might take a crack at that, this is Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. I think the combination of amendments that we've been talking about, particularly the consultant confer status to changes that formalize that process a little more, I think will help special districts to come in at the beginning, you know, as they often do now in most cases, and talk about the kinds of projects that will really be beneficial to them. We have examples of urban renewal districts in areas. One that springs immediately to mind is Wilsonville, for example, and there has been a lot of cooperation with the school district in that particular urban renewal area. So that kind of help and cooperation at the outset, that ability to assemble property for some of your taxing districts at the outset are some of the things that can help mitigate what it is that you're talking about. And I think that's going to be even brought to the fore more with the kinds of amendments that we're currently dealing with. And if I could talk a little bit about why, on a going forward basis, allowing the opt-out is also a little more difficult. You were talking about trying to come up with a mechanism wherein the other taxing districts that didn't participate would not necessarily share in the windfall. That is a much larger discussion that's probably going to have to involve the Department of Revenue and the property tax assessors. It's particularly under our current property tax system, you would have to recalculate, I would imagine, just about everything regarding urban renewal and the way you do things. So you're talking substantial law changes there, I would imagine, and I'm sure John Phillips can correct me if I'm wrong. I noticed you sitting in the back of the room. Sorry, John.
Okay, so anything else on this? Because I think I know where we're going to head on this. Anything, but I need to check it with Senator Pazanski. Anything else So, Senator Brzezinski, what I talked to our two Republican members who needed to go to caucus were, we'd do one dash two amendment that would just ensure that that time extension and substantial amendment or change language was included, just to clarify that issue. So dash two would have everything in the dash one plus that. The dash three amendment, and Dexter, I apologize for doing this to you, the dash three amendment would be the permissive allowing cities and counties the ability to opt out of the urban renewal district at the beginning. Does that sound right? And we'll bring it back Thursday?
Yeah, that's where I think we're at. I mean, we definitely, I think, want to clarify, because it seems like there might be some concern about the substantial changes to an extension qualifying for that. So clearly, I must just note that in the statute. And I think that's true. I think the other thing is for us to make a decision as to whether or not the urban renewal districts on the front end should have that, quote unquote, additional tool to consider whether they want to include a special taxing district inside the boundaries and under the parameters of the urban renewal district.
And so we'll reschedule this for Thursday. Senator Metzger?
Sounds good.
Sounds good? Okay, so we'll reschedule this for Thursday for a work session, and we'll look at what dash two and dash three amendments that would achieve. We'll have the option of, well, you know, since that the extension of time, I should correct that. Since that, everyone seems to agree that that just needs to be clarified, let's make sure that's in both the dash two and dash three, so that the only question is between the dash two and the dash three would be, do you allow this permissive language, opt-out language that the, Mr. Jensen was speaking to, do you allow that in?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, you can do it either way. I mean, to me, if you do the dash twos, we know they're going in. Then the question is, under the first proposed dash three, of having that permissive, you either add that into it as well. That would be, you know, and take both of them. Or you set them up where the dash ones, everything that's in the dash ones are going to be in the twos and the threes with the extension language, mm-hmm. plus that other part.
Is it duplicative, though, then, to have the same language? That was my only concern, is if you do the dash twos and the dash threes, you've added everything in the dash ones twice then. But I'm...
No, well, the dash, if you're going to make a dash two that just clarifies that an extension is a substantial change,
mm-hmm.
You basically folded the ones into the twos. Mm-hmm. They're going to need to be adopted no matter what.
The ones?
Yeah, well, it'll be the dash twos.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, the dash three will be only if we're going to add the additional tool of permissive. And so I don't know, I think the other way you're going to have Dexter doing more work of putting everything that's in the ones and twos into the three plus having that other part. And I don't know if you actually need to have that if you're going to just potentially adopt a new section.
Okay.
But we could leave it up for him to decide.
And Mary. You know, it's getting April when you've got dash twos and dash threes and dash fours flying around. It's a good sign that it's getting, you know, closer to sunny day. Okay, anything else? Anyone else want to talk on this issue? Did we leave anything? We'll bring it back Thursday morning for final action in this committee. Great. Thank you for the time. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 412. Gesundheit, Barbara. And the now known. And Paul, any comments before we adjourn the committee?
I think we'd be sure to make Dexter.